I wondered if you could just start by telling us, you know, what, how come you came to live here? What were you doing before that?
We lived in Macclesfield, but we were cavers and climbers and had wanted to move out closer to the Peak District for a long time, and we were actually looking for somewhere near Castleton. And we picked up the estate agent's details for this, dismissed it because of where it was, because Graham didn't know this area of the Peak particularly well. I did because I grew up in Stafford, so I knew it was a little bit better. So we drove down the lane and we just pulled up there where the van is now. And I said, don't care what it's like inside, I want to live here. It's the place, the views. It was the sort of remoteness, the fact that when I got out of the car, we couldn't hear any traffic because there are so many places in the Peak District where you can hear the A6. The unspoiltness, the feeling that it hadn't been invaded by the BBC workers and Waitrose Brigade.
So you came here and you thought, that's it. So just can you describe the landscape features that immediately got you going and made you think, this is it?
The combination of sort of soft hills, dry stone walls, trees, the moors on the top, the not total remoteness, but, you know, the sense that it was fairly isolated, not too close to some noise and bustling, quietness.
Just sort of looking out of your kitchen window, the first thing that strikes me is that it is that amazing thing of...
It's incredible.
You've got wide prospects, but there is a... this is not a bleak landscape, is it?
It moves up to a bleak landscape. Sure. You can see the sort of changes in it as you look out. I think the trees as well, because I like trees. Yeah, that's why we've planted some. Changed the landscape, see? We've made our impact on it.
So how much land have you got here?
We've got 5.48 hectares, I think.
When you were looking in all these other areas in the Peak District, were you looking for land?
No, we were looking for a couple of acres so I could keep a horse. And this place just happened to come with 14 acres. And I remember sort of thinking, that's not an issue. I want to live here because I want that view when I wash up. It just feels absolutely right. And we moved in and all of a sudden we had 14 acres and I went, oh my God. My husband, actually, his uncle was a farmer, but a farmer in Kent. So, and it was arable farming. So a little bit different, but he does know how to do things like drive tractors and use implements, which was helpful. We've got 14 acres, what are we going to do? And someone said, well, you can rent it out to a local farmer. And I thought, but I don't know the local farmers yet. Mm. And we could rent it out to the wrong person. And I want to feel that I control the land myself. So I thought we'd better learn what to do quickly. So I bought some haymaking machinery without telling Graham, and I bought two cows one night when I was slightly tipsy in the local pub from one of the local wheeler dealers, and Graham came home from work and went, what are them in the field? I said, cows. Where they come from? I bought them.
Had you ever milked a cow before? Or?
They weren't milk cows. I did think we might have a house cow, and they're Dexters, which you could use as a dual purpose, little ones. So I thought I might be able to handle little ones, but I discovered little ones have mild tempers.
How old were they?
One of them was 7, and actually we bought one from the guy in the pub, and we bought two more from our next door neighbours. They were in calf with calves at foot, so that was quite nice. So I got two little calves and knew that I was going to get two calves born, and we had one that we bought from the man in the pub.
So when you got these animals, did you do sort of a lot of reading to sort of figure this out, or did you talk to a bit of both?
Fair bit of reading, sort of. Mr. Google is quite useful, actually. Talked to local people, pretended I knew what I was talking about, and then suddenly thought, oh my God, the grass is growing, because we moved in January. We're gonna have to make hay. Graham, do you know how to make hay? No. What do? We have to mow it and dry it. Yeah, well, I've got this machinery, how do you use it? And with a little bit of help from a neighbour, just sorting out how to fix the mower up properly, make it work properly, we watched a local farmer mow. So we thought, right, must be a good day for mowing. So let's put the mower on and mow it.
Then we watched him TED it. I thought, right, get the tedder out, let's TED it. And we copied everything he did.
That was 10 years ago. Well, yeah.
So was that was a very steep learning curve, wasn't it, in the first...
Yeah, it was. It was. It was quite good fun, and it was very satisfying when we got all the hay in, and that actually managed to make fairly reasonable hay and do everything without killing ourselves or breaking anything, and got people to help us, and it was quite good.
And you got all the buildings that you needed to
store. Yeah, it came with quite a lot of agricultural buildings, so yeah, we had to use them, didn't we?
So how did you feel as a newcomer? Did you feel comfortable? Was it easy to make connections with people?
Really easy. We moved in and nobody knew anything about us, except that our name's Wollstonecroft, and one of the local names is Woolliscroft, and everybody just heard Woolliscroft and assumed we must be related to the Woolliscroft family somewhere. And because we'd got cows, and because we'd got a tractor, and because we were making our own hay, they all assumed that we must have been a farming family. So they assumed we were farmers. And it was about 4 years on when I'd asked Richard Gold to come and help us bale, because it had been rain. We'd got some grass down and it was raining, and we just needed it. It was forecast rain and we needed it baled before. He said, "Someone tells me that you weren't always farmers." And I said, "No." "Oh, we all thought you were farmers because you knew what to do." He said, "How did you know what to do?" I said, "Because I looked it up."
But you found people very positive and friendly.
Incredibly friendly, incredibly helpful, incredibly welcoming. And I would say our closest friends now, and some of the closest friends we've ever had, are local farmers who've lived here for a long time. And it's really nice.
You've got to know the area, obviously, very, very well, and in a way that most people who do come into an area don't get to know it, because you've come straight into sort of a bit of a sharing experience, haven't you, with the local farmers?
Yes, yeah.
So can you tell us what your current operation is in terms of the farm, what you're doing
on
the farm?
My current operations, I've actually got a share farming agreement with a young lad, because 2 years ago, Graham and I both hurt our backs within a few months of each other, and we had a very poorly cow, and we had to milk her every day, and neither of us could physically milk her every day, and we had to get one of the local farmers to come down and strip her out every day because we physically couldn't. And I suddenly thought, if we're in a situation where we're having to, you know, we're only smallholders, it's not important to us. We've got them because we're doing conservation grazing, we've got them because we're caring for the landscape, but actually if we're having to involve other people and put pressure on them, it's not fair. So we sold the cows, and we asked Matthew, who is the son of one of the local farmers, if he would like to share farm the land with us. So I do the stewardship and conservation, I do educational access, I have groups of school children coming round for visits, and I trained as a forest schools practitioner as well to enhance that, because one of my big things that's all interest has always been trees, flowers, the environment, why small holdings are really good for the environment. And Matthew grazes it with sheep, but between us we discuss which field needs to be grazed, and we're trying to manage it so that the sheep aren't wrecking the flowers that we've already got. And he operates within our stewardship agreement, and it works really well. I've got a few of my own sheep running with his sheep, so he does most of the animal sides, I do most of the people side and the conservation side, and between us it works quite well now.
So you've got sheep?
Yeah,
I've
got a few Shetland sheep, and Matthew's got about 40 odd. I do educational access, and I have really struggled to get, I was really struggling to get the visit. We can have up to 25 visits a year under our high level stewardship agreement for educational access. Actually, I have about 12 a year, I get about one a month, because we don't do any over winter, not many over winter, do a few. We have wheelchair access and our boardwalk, it goes through our rushes, past a hedge, through it's a growing hazel coppice, we've planted it as a hazel coppice, past some dry stone walls, and then onto a pond. You've got a stream habitat, a dry stone wall habitat, a wetland habitat, a tree habitat, a coppice habitat, a pond habitat, all within this short area that anybody doing environmental studies in a wheelchair can access that habitat I've had two wheelchair users. That's it. And I know that it could be used so much better. And so I've had that money, and it won't actually ever get used, because if I want it to be used, I have got to go out and I have got to aggressively market it myself. I've now, through Facebook, I got in touch with a home education group, and I got in touch with Woodcraft Folk, and I got a group of people, and somebody else said, how much would we have to pay to meet here every month? And I said, you wouldn't have to pay anything. All you would have to do is meet here every month and fill in a feedback form, and as long as it's for 2 hours and there's at least 6 of you, I can claim onto my educational app.
So you completely committed to this. Can you tell us why small holdings are good? They're good for the environment.
Well, I sort of realised very quickly that we were only ever going to make a loss if we were going to breed Dexter cattle. It wasn't going to make us a profit, and it was going to be a lot of hard work for nothing. And when we first moved here, I knew nothing about flowers. Well, I knew a daisy and a buttercup and a dandelion, foxgloves, that's probably about it, bluebells, all the ones that everybody knows. Went for a walk with one of my old townie friends up round the back of the Roaches and came across so many flowers, and I said, you know what, I'd really love to know the names of all these flowers. So I sort of set about trying to identify all the flowers on the farm, and then I sort of thought, I'd like to know a little bit more about conservation. So I enrolled on an HMC course in countryside management and conservation at Rees Heath, which taught me exactly what I wanted to know, and realised that one of the quickest ways, or the best ways, for us to make this profitable as opposed to costing us money to run, because land costs money to maintain. Unless you just let it out and lose control of it, land costs money to maintain. There were dry stone walls that were tumbling down, and I like dry stone walls, and we wanted to rebuild them but didn't have the money, and I suddenly realised actually there are grants that you can access, and there are grants that you can access, but you need to be in some sort of stewardship scheme. So did a little bit of reading, found out about high level stewardship and entry level stewardship, and I applied for high level stewardship and I didn't get it. Interestingly, started my HMC and realised what environmental features they were looking for, rewrote my application saying, we've got this, 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 this and this, and got high level stewardship. And the money from that, actually, along with single farm payment, made us a very slight profit, and it also meant that we could get funding to rebuild the walls. So we built quite a lot of walling, and we got some funding from the English Woodland to plant the trees, drove through them when you came down the drive. And what's interesting, I don't think we've got the planning permission to plant them now.
So, I mean, this happened, what, in the first 2 years of you
about
being here?
About the first 3 years.
First 3 years, yeah. So you got involved in that. So you got the higher level stewardship, which helped you to do this.
Yeah, we got that in 2009. It would have been 4 years in. We moved here in 2005.
And that has made it possible for you to do to manage the land in the way that you want to.
Yes.
And to
without that, we would have just rented it out to a local dairy farmer, and he would have managed it. He manages everything else. And what I find sort of sad, some of the fields around about have got bigger because the walls have gone and the trees that were on the walls have gone. And you can look over there, and that used to be a field that was divided up. And since we've been here, the wall's gone and trees have been taken out, and it's managed as one big field, which, when your profits are cut to, you know, your milk price is going down and down and down and down and down, you don't want to fanny about not being able to mow up next to your walls, and you want to be able to just get in the field and mow it. And I can understand why it happens. It's people who are on small holdings, I guess, and people who aren't dependent on farming for their main income are the ones that have the luxury of being able to concentrate on conservation. Because a lot of farmers around here, it's not a rich farming area. You know, they're not rolling in it. You don't have time to fanny around building dry stone walls that you don't need. And if it's going to be easier to, you've got a large herd cattle, it's easier to take the wall out and manage that whole field for silage and plough it up and manage it for silage.
Have you sort of engaged in this discussion with the farmers around here, like how they're under the cosh, the financial cosh of, like, obviously food prices and trying to, particularly dairying, it's just horrendous now, isn't it? But
talk to the lad that's tedding our field at the moment, he would say that you don't make enough from the stewardship. It's supposed to compensate you, but actually you just want to put muck on, get the grass growing, get the grass in. And the reality is, no, you need to make life easier for yourself and make it easier to make a profit. You don't want to make it harder. And he's right. Government is supposedly behind encouraging small businesses, but it certainly doesn't encourage small scale farming. The way it's set up in this country now, encouraging large scale farming, because it is only large scale farming that's going to be profitable. I'm not going to get basic payment scheme anymore, because although we have 4.48 hectares, you have to have 5 hectares to get basic payment. I've got woodland on some of mine, so it's not agriculture anymore, and I'm getting farm woodland payment on it for another 3 years. I now am not a farmer anymore.
Yeah, okay.
And quite interestingly, I've been told in the pub, I used to be considered a farmer and they call me a farmer. They now tease me and call me a hobby farmer because I don't get single farm payment. That's been really wrong, making the limit 5 hectares. For me, it's totally disincentivized me. Because why would I want to carry on with stewardship? It made the difference between me making a paper profit and a paper loss. And you suddenly think, and if I'm farming it and doing high level stewardship, I have to insure it as a farmer, whereas if I let it out to somebody else, they're responsible for the insurance, and the insurance costs me about £2,000 a year. I am paying the same insurance as a large dairy farm because the risks are more or less the same. Your acreage doesn't matter. We have the same buildings. So we've got a large shipping. We have the same buildings. You have the same risks. We've got public footpaths which immediately shoots your insurance premiums up. If I let that land out, it's his problem, not mine. I hate getting my insurance bill because my insurance is more than the income I'm ever getting from the land. And I've got to have that public liability insurance, and I've got to have employer's liability insurance. I have to pay employer's liability insurance, because if you decided to come and help me move some hay bales, because you saw me and Graham struggling in the field moving hay bales, you, even though you're a neighbour, you are still my employee. So I think now it will be Matthew. At the moment we have a share farming agreement, but as soon as my stewardship comes to the end, he will just operate on a grazing licence, and it will be his land to do with what he likes. However much I try to persuade him that hay meadows are good, he's not having it.
No.
So, you know, other than saying to him, you can have a grazing licence on the condition that you always manage that field up there, which is really pretty, as a hay meadow, you can do what you like with the rest. So
that's what you do.
That's what I do. It's what I have to do. Don't want to cope with the bureaucracy. The next door, you know, next door but one's just said, we're going to do what we like, but, you know, what we want with the land. I cannot cope with the bureaucracy anymore. You know, I am not prepared to fill in the forms. I'm not prepared. He said, it's just too much. And I do enough of this at work. Why should I? And, you know, sadly, it is people like us that... It is the smallholders. I think I'm right. I don't think I'm the only one that feels like this.
No, it's not a view that's... I've heard it from other parts of the Peak District, and